court, ladies and gentlemen, if we can commence evening's proceedings. Foundational question, which is the issue of the public's right to know and freedom of information, which of course I don't need to tell you has been in the public domain for some long while. And it does strike me that in relation to the course that we've been doing so far, the link is this: right from the first lecture, we've been emphasizing the nature of the constitutional compact, the way in which our society is constituted. And one of the things that I hope you would have taken was the way in which the courts have been drawn in increasingly to a protection of constitutional system. One of the things which we'll talk about tomorrow night in the last session, which I hope that we can have an engagement with you, because I think this is important for us all, is something again which was raised, which I mentioned in my concluding remarks last night, that Chief Justice Arthur Shuskell said in his speech yesterday, which I think will soon be published, because I know it's been circulated to the press, in which, having analysed something which we'll talk about again tomorrow, the question that we posed at the beginning, well, what's wrong with the judges? I mean, why is there an attack on the judges? Is it because suddenly you were apartheid judges? Answer can't be that. Is it about the Constitution? Then are the judges not in tune with the Constitution? And for reasons I think we've advanced and we'll discuss again with you tomorrow, I think that, as he rightly concluded, it can't be. He posed a really interesting question, which I throw out, and hopefully we can all think about and talk about tomorrow, which he said, well, if it's not that the judges are counter-revolutionary because they're all apartheid under Archimedes, or it's not because the judges are out of tune with the Constitution because the Constitution is something which, by and large, the judges have done reasonably well, highly, but reasonably well, then why is it that? And Shaskelson then said, this is a significant point that relates to tonight and tomorrow. He said, well, if it's because the powers that be don't like the Constitution, and therefore the system of government which we chose in 1994, then perhaps they should have the courtesy and the honesty to say so, so that we can have a proper debate. Now, one of the tests of whether a government really is prepared to be, to answer that question positively, is going to be the question of how much information they are prepared to allow the public to know. Or, to put it differently, is the government prepared to respect the public's right to know, which in turn is essential to the public's participation in a constitutional process, which in turn is central to constitutional democracy? That's really the question. Now, since 2007, when the ANC's 52nd National Conference, there have been increasing mutterings and mailings about the media. Now, let's be quite honest. All governments moan about the media. Not a government in the world that likes criticism. And they all moan about the media. The question is, what do they do about it? In 2007, at its annual conference, the ANC had quite a lot to say about this. So it said the following on media freedom: the ANC must promote the school of thought which articulates media freedom within the context of the South African Constitution, in terms of which the notion of the right to freedom of expression should not be elevated above other equally important rights, such as the right to privacy, and more important rights and values such as human dignity. Well, that's itself an interesting question to quite what they mean. Get some further indication of what they mean when they talk about on the establishment of a media appeals tribunal. Conference adopts a recommendation the establishment of a media appeals tribunal to investigate, endorses such investigation be directed at examining the principle of immediate repetitive appeals tribunal and associated modalities for implementation. It notes that this tribunal would strengthen, complement, and support the current self-regulatory mechanisms of the press for the public interest. And on they go, suggesting that in fact we need a strengthening of self-regulation. Then, of course, not that long after, we started getting the various drafts of the Protection of State Information Bill. And we also have, parallel to that, of course, the media themselves investigating possibilities of self-regulation, and indeed, in the newspaper, the Business Day of today, I believe, there was an article by Chris Vick talking about there are two fascinating public listening exercises underway that could have a profound effect on the future relationship between the government and the media. The first is a roadshow on media regulation by the Press Freedom Commission, appointed under the auspices of the current Press Council. The second is the National Council of Provinces roadshow on the Protection of State Information Bill, following heavy criticism of the bill when it went through the National Assembly. And then, towards the end, he writes, the tribunal, and with it the push for co-regulation, independent regulation driven by Parliament, are not going to go away, nor the demands that the media should decide their own regulatory future. Granted, expecting the media establishment to allow others to decide the future of their regulation is a bit like expecting turkeys to vote for Christmas. But ultimately, the ANC's argument that society as a whole should decide on the regulatory framework. This means Parliament, as the gathering place that society's elected representatives should decide. Parliamentarians, the ANC argues, should be the ones who vote for Christmas. And Parliament is where the conversation should be happening. Not a media-sponsored initiative, but the rather grandiose title of Press Freedom Commission. The Protection of State Information Law process has taught us that there's something to be gained by the ruling party and media institutions sitting down to literally well-talk turkey. And seeing as the turkeys are probably have to vote for Christmas sooner or later, what better time is they start doing it than now? The point is that we've got both these processes going at the same time. And there can be no doubt about it that the outcome of both of them is utterly central to the questions I pose. Namely, what rights are we going to have to know? What rights will we then have to participate? And further, what future, ultimately, constitutional democracy? Stakes are pretty high. Now, mercifully, I don't have to do more than pose these questions and introduce our guest speaker, and I'm delighted to do so. Because I've had the privilege of interviewing her before for a television program. Let me just tell you something about Shravia Parfulhanti, who is an associate in the dispute resolution practice of Wenger Wenzel, where she joined as a candidate attorney in 2007, serving articles in the dispute resolution department and the media department. She was admitted as an attorney in 2009. She works in the team that specializes in media law. And that team at Wenger Wenzel has been extremely active in all of these processes that I've outlined. I said to her that it was rather curious that she obtained her LLB cum laude. That wasn't the curious part, that I understand, having interviewed you, I expected that. What was curious was that it was at the University of Victoria, which I show you that transformation can take place. So indeed, when I first went to that university, well, you know, the sort of intellectual giants, those sort of people, I suppose, who now are represented in the form of people like Victor Matfield and others. But there she went there, and then she had an LLM, in human rights and democratizing in Africa, also at the University of Pretoria. In 2006, she clerked for Chief Justice Pius Langer at the Constitutional Court of South Africa, and in 2009 completed a 5 months secondment as an intern in the appeals chamber of the International Criminal Court. So I'm really very pleased that you've come to talk to us about these issues. Without any further ado, let me therefore over to you, and then we will hopefully have some time for questions before we conclude the proceedings.
Thanks for that introduction, Dennis. So tonight, as Dennis has said, I'm going to be speaking primarily about two issues, being the issue of the self-regulation, or indeed what type of regulation the media should have, and also the protection of state information bill, which has been the buzzword that's been on everybody's lips. Well, sort of ran down our lips because it is a media issue, and every time you pick up the newspaper, that's what you read about. And so that's an issue that everybody here will know something about, or at least think that they know something about. And so tonight I'm going to deal with those two issues in a fair amount of detail. But before we actually go there, I think it's important to start by looking at the foundation of freedom of expression itself. Now, freedom of expression is contained, or the right to freedom of expression is contained in Section 16 of the Constitution. And if I can just read out to you what Section 16 says. It says, everyone has the right to freedom of expression, which includes freedom of the media and the press, freedom to receive or impart information and ideas. So you actually have a right to receive information, which is contained within the right to freedom of expression, but also separately as a self-standing right in Section 32 of the Constitution, and freedom of artistic creativity, academic freedom, and freedom of scientific research. So you can see from what is listed in Section 16 of our Constitution that the right to freedom of expression is actually very broad. It's not just about standing in a corner and having your say about political issues. It's also about being able to draw a picture if that's what sort of floats your boat. Now, Section 16.2 of the Constitution says that this right does not extend to propaganda of war, incitement of imminent violence, and advocacy of hatred based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and that constitutes incitement to force harm. And that's what is commonly referred to as hate speech. So it's very clear from the way that Section 16 of our Constitution is structured that there are certain types of expression which our Constitution actually doesn't deem worthy of protection. And that is, in fact, what the courts have said. The courts have said that they adopt a very generous approach to freedom of expression, that everything that is not in Section 16.2 is part of the right to freedom of expression. You have a right to express yourself in that way if it's not incitement to imminent violence, propaganda for war, or hate speech. So an example of this, which I think most ordinary people would find quite disturbing, was in the Doria case, where the Constitutional Court was faced with having to consider a challenge to legislative provisions that prohibited the possession of child pornography. And the court said that child pornography is a form of expression and that it's capable of being protected as a form of freedom of expression under Section 61. So that is how broad the right is interpreted. But importantly, of course, the court then went on to say that the limitation on creation and possession of child pornography is a justifiable limitation because of the obvious harm that is caused by such forms of expression. So the court takes a very wide view of what freedom of expression actually amounts to. And what the court said in Doria, which I think is very important as when we lay the foundation for what types of expression are considered acceptable in our society, is that, and I quote, the right applies not only to information or ideas that are favorably received or regarded as inoffensive or as a matter of indifference, but also to those that offend, shock, or disturb. So freedom of expression is not where we all hold hands and sing kumbaya. It's also when we write, you know, caustic opinion pieces, as you so often find in newspapers like the Sunday Times or the Cape Times, basically slating people for all sorts of things, which we may or may not agree with. So at the end of the day, freedom of expression covers the type of media reportage which, as Dennis had pointed out, the ANC has said, is not really acceptable. Reportage which, in the view expressed in the discussion document that was initially released on the Media Appeals Tribunal, the view expressed there was that the media at the moment tends to report in a way which is not supportive of government's programs and which is very critical and in fact anti the ANC and the ruling party. Now, unfortunately for the ANC, this is part of the right to freedom of expression, and the media simply cannot be prevented from expressing itself in a way that is against what the government has to say. And similarly, any person is entitled to establish a newspaper which is pro-government. And I think in this country, we unfortunately don't see a lot of that. In some other, and I hesitate to use the word more developed democracies, because I don't think the word always fits, but in many other democracies, you have a far more lively debate within the media, and you see newspapers, television stations, etc., that are pro or anti-government, and we don't really have that happening in the South African scene, so the opinion seems to always be going in the right direction, but the point is that both sides of that debate are worthy of protection. So why is it that freedom of expression is protected under our constitution? Now, our constitutional court and our courts in general have expressed themselves on this issue on a number of occasions, and there are a few principles that can be distilled from those judgments. Firstly, freedom of expression is intrinsically valuable. The ability to say what you have to say in the way you want to say it and when you want to say it is part of your right to dignity and your right to be heard. And that, of course, is protected under Section 10 of our Constitution, the right to dignity. Secondly, freedom of expression is essential to the enjoyment of many of the other rights in the Constitution. A basic example is the issue of service delivery. If freedom of expression was not protected under the Constitution, and other rights like the right to hold a peaceful assembly, etc., you wouldn't see all the service delivery protests that you see at the moment. So people would basically be stifled from saying, hey, we don't get enough basic services if freedom of expression was not protected. And then lastly, freedom of expression is a fundamental prerequisite for democracy. And the role that is played by the media in this regard is also quite vital and is also being emphasized by the courts in various judgments. For example, in Kumalo v. Kolomisa, the Constitutional Court said that the mass media play a role of undeniable importance. They bear an obligation to provide citizens both with information and with a platform for the exchange of ideas, which is crucial to the development of a democratic culture. But that said, our courts have rejected the idea that the media has a greater right to freedom of expression or that the media is somehow exceptional. Ordinary citizens and journalists have exactly the same right to freedom of expression. It's just that it plays out in different ways when it comes to protection of the media because they have different interests. For example, when we talk about attendance at quasi-judicial tribunals, sometimes the media would be allowed to attend those tribunals on the basis of certain restrictions, but ordinary members of the public wouldn't. And that's not because the media has more of a right to freedom of expression. It's because in such tribunals, sometimes there's a necessity of limiting access, and the media is there so that everybody in the public can get to know what happened at that particular proceeding without actually being able to attend the proceeding. So there is that equality between us as ordinary people out there and the media with respect to our right to freedom of expression. And the reason why I make this point as well is to say that this whole debate around freedom of expression and access to information is not a media issue. It's an issue that is important to each and every single one of us because we each are able to exercise that right. For instance, when we talk about restrictions on what can be reported, in this day and age, we find that there is a gradual collapse between the traditional media and ordinary people because of blogs and social networking sites, Twitter and the likes. There are a lot of people out there who are referred to as citizen journalists who have basically set themselves up as one-man newspapers online. So it's increasingly becoming difficult to draw the line between who is a journalist and who isn't. And that's why we each need to guard, jealously guard, that public space in terms of expression. So, now that we've laid the foundation for why is it that we actually value the right to freedom of expression and how it's protected in our law. I want to just delve into these two specific issues that I spoke to at the beginning, the Protection of State Information Bill, which is commonly known as the Secrecy Bill, and the regulation of the media. So with respect to the Secrecy Bill, it's actually one of the most controversial pieces of legislation. I'm sure you would agree. And I can see from those that are in the audience that there are a few of you who have been around for a lot longer than I have. And I'm sure you would agree that it's one of the most controversial pieces of legislation, especially in the post-apartheid era, that, have been mooted in Parliament. And it's really drawn a huge amount of criticism, even internationally as well. So although the bill is arguably one of the most contested pieces of legislation that we face with at the moment, a lot of its critics, unfortunately, are not aware of precisely what the legally problematic aspects of the bill are. And we see a lot of people standing on platforms and writing in all sorts of newspapers, etc., criticizing the bill, but a lot of it has been inaccurate, and I think this has actually done a disservice to the public and a disservice to the quality of the debate around these issues, because inaccurate reportage, which then leads to criticism, doesn't necessarily advance a cause which is worthy of being advanced. So what is this bill actually all about? The purpose of the Protection of State Information Bill, I'll call it the secrecy bill, to use the term that's been coined by the media. The purpose of the secrecy bill is to actually reform the current legislation that is on the statute books regarding state secrets. What we have at the moment is various pieces of legislation that deal with secrecy in different ways. But the most comprehensive is the Protection of Information Act of 1982. And the year in which it was passed, 1982, should tell you what the content of that legislation looks like. I can say without fear of contradiction that it is unconstitutional, even though it hasn't been tested in court yet. It's mostly not applied by the government anymore, and I think that's because there is an acknowledgement of the unconstitutionality of that. With respect to classification of documents, that is dealt with by a cabinet policy called the Minimum Information Security Standards, which was adopted post-1994. And in as much as the bill seeks to create some kind of proper regulation around classification of documents, that the Minimum Information Security Standards, it seeks to create some kind of proper regulation around classification of documents, but unfortunately it also, in my view, falls far short of what the Constitution requires. It's overbroad in many respects. And so that's the background against which this legislation is being passed. We actually have legislation on the statute books which is far worse than what is being proposed. And that is not to say that what is being proposed is then okay, but that is actually the reason why this bill is being enacted. It wasn't proposed in order to silence the media. It was actually proposed in order to reform the existing legislation. Now, the effect that some of the terms in the bill have is to cause problems for the media and for freedom of expression in general. As a starting point, the bill creates three classification levels, being confidential, secret, and top secret. And as you can imagine with the terminology, it's kind of self-explanatory. It's increasing levels of secrecy and increasing levels of danger that the public could be exposed to if the information is disclosed. And the foundation for those classification levels is national security. And national security has been defined in the law, I'll read it out to you, as including the protection of the people of the Republic and the territorial integrity of the Republic against, one, the threat of use of force, and the following acts, hostile acts of foreign intervention directed at undermining the constitutional order of the Republic, terrorism or terrorist-related activities, espionage, exposure of states to treaty matters with the intention of undermining the constitutional order of the Republic, exposure of economic, scientific, or technological secrets that are vital to the Republic, sabotage, serious violence directed at overthrowing the constitutional order of the Republic. So those are all the things that have been defined as falling within the ambit of national security. And quite frankly, I don't think that there's anything wrong with any of those. The definition that we see at the moment is streets ahead of where we actually started. When the bill was first introduced in 2008, it had a definition of something called national interest. And that basically covered absolutely everything, including the right of the people of South Africa to enjoy a good life. That was all defined within the ambit of national interest, which would then attract classification. So the definition has been significantly tightened up. Now, who can classify documents? That's also been limited to the security services. So when we talk about the security services, we're talking about the National Intelligence Agency, we're talking about South African Secret Service, COMSEC, which is the kind of technology wing of the Secret Services, the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence in Parliament, which oversees the activities of the intelligence community, and also the Inspector General of Intelligence. So all of those, which clearly fall within the national security arena, those are the entities that are permitted to classify information. When the bill actually started out, every organ of state was going to be able to classify information, including Telkom and SAA and the likes. But that has now been removed from the bill. So as things stand, only the security services are. The Defense Force will also be included in that, and crime intelligence division within the police will be able to classify documents. And classification will basically entail the document will be stamped with a big red stamp that says classified, or something of the like, so that if you pick it up, you know that you've got a hot potato in your hand. And classification will not be able to endure beyond a 20-year period. So they've put a 20-year cap on it. So that, in a nutshell, is basically what the bill does. Who can classify documents and how long the classification will last for. Now, of course, the bill is a lot more detailed than that. It has a lot of complex things that we could go into, but we won't go into for tonight's purposes. So what are the issues with the bill? Why is everybody actually up in arms, and why should we be up in arms about this legislation? Now, firstly, it contains a number of provisions that create offences. And these offences are draconian in nature. It creates an offence which is called, which it refers to as espionage, and I'll read the definition of that. It's an offence to unlawfully and intentionally communicate, deliver, make available, obtain, collect, or capture classified information which a person knows or ought reasonably to have known would directly or indirectly benefit a foreign state. So the idea behind espionage is that you shouldn't get classified information and use it to benefit a foreign state. Then the hostile activity offence, which makes it an offence to unlawfully and intentionally communicate, deliver, make available, or obtain information which you know or reasonably to have known directly or indirectly benefit a non-state actor engaged in hostile activity. So the difference there is with espionage, you're benefiting a foreign state. With hostile activity, you're benefiting a non-state actor like, I don't know, the Taliban or something, which is not a foreign state, but it's obviously a hostile entity. It's an offense to disclose classified information in any form, to possess classified information, to access classified information. So there's a range of offenses that are basically created in the book. And that would not necessarily be a problem if it wasn't for the fact that there are no defenses that would cater for a situation where you have found out that a document has been classified in order to conceal wrongdoing, and therefore you want to disclose this document, publish it in the newspapers, expose the wrongdoers, etc. You can't do that because you will get prosecuted. In terms of the bill, what you're expected to do is to take it to the nearest police station like an obedient citizen, hand it in, and report whatever criminal offense you think has been committed, and leave it at that. You're not entitled to take it any further than that. And that is really the reason why there's been such an outcry, especially from the media, because there is a real requirement for a public interest defense in this legislation, which doesn't exist. And now what do we mean by public interest? That's a very difficult question to answer. I'm saying, well, how long is a piece of string? It's something which courts have wrestled with over time, but it's not a concept that is so nebulous that it cannot be given any content. Because public interest is something which is utilized by our courts in many existing fields of law. For example, in the area of breach of privacy. One of the classic defenses to a breach of privacy is public interest. So a famous privacy case that most people would have read about in the newspapers was when our late health minister, Mantu Shabalala Msimang, was hospitalized and she had to have, I think it was a liver transplant, and the allegation was that she was an alcoholic, that she was a kleptomaniac, and the likes, and that she was abusing her power, that she had jumped the queue for organ transplants, basically every conceivable thing that a minister should not do had been done. And what she did is that she took the Sunday Times to court for being in possession of her medical records and for publishing those. And in terms of the National Health Act, you're actually not entitled to be in possession of those records. And so the Sunday Times was forced to give the records back to her. But importantly, the court said that they weren't going to be prohibited from publishing those because it was clearly in the public interest for the public to be made aware that a cabinet minister was behaving in this way, was abusing her power, etc. So I discussed this case to illustrate the fact that the courts know how to handle the issue of public interest. And it usually includes things like cabinet ministers lying about things, public officials or public figures misleading the public, behaving in a hypocritical way, issues that would affect public health and public safety, issues that would affect your political decision making. Those types of things are generally considered to be in the public interest. So it's not impossible for a public interest defense to actually be crafted and relatively narrowly tailored, or as narrowly tailored as possible, to be inserted into the law. And that's one of the issues that, of course, is still being debated. The government has rejected from the get-go the idea of public interest defense. And to be fair to them, I want to state the reason for that, the reason that's been publicly stated anyway, which is that a public interest defense will only operate retrospectively. So the cat will already be out of the bag by the time the public interest defense issue gets decided by a court. And what they're concerned about is that ordinary citizens out there and members of the media are not the right people to take decisions about national security. And if you're going to get a document that has been classified and publish that document because in your personal opinion, people out there deserve to know about it, you could actually be compromising national security. And even if you are later not able to prove that it was in the public interest to do so, and therefore you're convicted of an offense, it would be too late because that the national security would already have been compromised. So that's their position on the issue. They are concerned that this will open the floodgates, it will nullify the protection of classified information because they will constantly have to be wondering whether they're going to open the front page of a newspaper on a Sunday morning and find top secret documents that will totally undermine the security of South Africa published there on the basis that the editor thinks it's in the public interest to do so. So that's really the concern. And obviously the response from the media is that the media, contrary to belief that is held in some circles, is not completely irresponsible. They do have some form of internal controls, and these things do get checked. And ultimately, it's better to err on the side of freedom of expression than on the side of secrecy in a democracy. And we have to accept that in a democracy, sometimes there will be sacrifices that will have to be made, and mistakes that will have to be made. But it's better to have more openness than to have less openness, because we're afraid of what will happen if there's more openness. So that's basically, that's not basically it. There's one or two other issues around the info bill. I think the issue of public interest is the one that has received the most public profile. But there's actually a number of other issues that are of major concern. And I'll just highlight two or three of them. One that is of major concern is that even though they've limited the ability to classify information to only the security services, they have now, in this latest draft of the law, conferred on every single member of the security services who deals with classified information the power to classify documents. So any member of the National Intelligence Agency, any member of the Secret Service who deals with matters that may be confidential will actually be entitled to classify those documents of their own accord. And the only safeguard that's been placed there is that that decision will have to be confirmed by their superiors at a later point. But there's no timeline on that. It could be weeks, months, or years before it goes back to their superior to be confirmed. But in the meantime, all the consequences of classification will follow. So if you get the document and you want to publish it, you will be convicted if you do so. And that is a major problem. Also, the definition of national security, even though it is much better and more workable definition than it was before, it has the word includes in it. And includes is basically an open door, because one could potentially then argue that something that is not part of the definition does fall within the concept of national security. So those are some of the issues that are still going to be debated at the National Council of Organizers. And there's going to be wide public consultation on the issue. I think it's going to be happening in every province, and it would be a good thing to actually take the time, if you have the time, to go and attend the public consultation, because the idea is that the National Council of Provinces wants to hear every person out there on this issue, and as citizens we have a right to attend those consultations and to be heard. So those are the issues around the Protection of State Information Bill. Now, with respect to the mooted Media Appeals Tribunal, which is basically the government's idea of how to solve the irresponsible reportage that's going out there in the media, it's not really clear what it is that they intend to do, because even though there's been a discussion document on the issue, which is not quite dated, in 2010, they've never actually set out in clear terms what this Media Appeals Tribunal is going to be all about, who is going to be sitting on that tribunal, what its powers would be, etc., etc. But there are certain parameters of what it can and cannot do in order to be constitutionally compliant. And the reasons for that is that there are certain powers that, if the Media Appeals Tribunal were to have, would actually render it unconstitutional, because it would then exercise too much control over media content. And also in terms of the composition, the problem is who is actually going to appoint these people. And this is not a problem, these are not issues that are only limited to the Media Appeals Tribunal. It's also relevant to the current debate that's going through the Press Freedom Commission about how are we actually going to regulate. The difficulty is that the moment you have an external party coming in, the questions will start to be, who is going to appoint these people? Will the government have a say in it? Is it going to be legislated, for example? And if there's going to be an external party that then dictates to the media what is right and what is wrong, that is automatically a limitation of media freedom. And what really needs to then be debated is whether or not that's justifiable. It's one thing if the media were to set it up themselves and to say, we're going to set up an independent body that doesn't consist only of us. We're going to have external parties that are not members of the media, not ex-editors and so on and so forth, sitting on that body. And it's another thing to say legislation will be passed requiring the media to subject themselves to an external party's adjudication. One may ask, what is the difference between the print media and the broadcast media? Because the broadcast media, in terms of legislation, are required to subject themselves to external regulation. If they are not members of the Broadcasting Complaints Commission of South Africa, then they have to be under ICASA's jurisdiction. ICASA is the Independent Communication Authority of South Africa. That's a body that's been set up by the government to regulate communications in South Africa. What is the difference? Why is it that the broadcast media have to subject themselves to ICASA and the CCSA in terms of legislation, but the print media must just go about doing whatever they like? Well, the fundamental difference really historic. Historically, the notion has been that because broadcasting is something which is has a limited number of participants, and especially in the field of radio, where the spectrum has always been limited, it had to be controlled by somebody, and somebody had to decide who is going to get what portion of the radio frequency spectrum, and also the broadcasting spectrum in terms of television. And because of the limited availability of broadcasting space, that justified intervention from a government entity. And in terms of section 192 of the Constitution, the government is actually mandated to set up a body to control broadcasting in South Africa, and a body that will take into consideration issues around redressing imbalances of the past and that type of thing. So the existence of a body like ICASA is actually constitutionally mandated, and it's historical. In most countries you find, in any democratic country you'll find, that broadcasting is regulated and usually more tightly regulated. Whereas the print media has always been a very, very different space. It's a space that any person can enter. As I said previously, the internet has made it even broader, because every person now has a print platform from their laptop, effectively. Even if you don't have a laptop, you can just write something on a piece of paper and distribute it on the street corner. So print has always been seen as a place which is effectively free, whereas broadcasting has always been subject to some form of limitation. So it's more historic. So the argument that says, well, why don't the print media just subject themselves to exactly the same regulation that broadcasting media? It has historically, it's not completely accurate, and more importantly, going forward, it's becoming more and more inaccurate, because again, with the advent of the internet, a lot of broadcasting is happening online as well. And so there again, the distinction between broadcast media and print media is actually collapsing, and convergence is starting to take place. So one, again, would argue that there should be more and more freedom for both print and broadcast, and not less freedom for the print media. So effectively, what I was talking about previously was that there are certain limitations, effectively, on what an external regulatory body, whether it be a media appeals tribunal set up by the government or any other body by any other name that sets up to control the media, there are limitations on what it can do. First of all, it must be free from political, economic, or other influence by the government. This will mean that from a structural perspective, there have to be adequate safeguards that have to be built in order to ensure independence. How will the members of any such body be appointed? If the overwhelming number are appointed by a government entity or by parliament for that matter, one would have to wonder whether it's not government control that's happening at the back door. Secondly, the media body that's created mustn't be given the power to, for example, suspend journalists or prevent them from working as journalists in the future. And this is something that was tried in South America in the 1980s. And the country in question was taken to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. And it gave a very powerful decision. It wasn't an adjudication, but it was an opinion on the matter. And the court effectively said that legislation that seeks to license journalists and that then said to someone, you can't be a journalist anymore because of what you wrote and because you've infringed XYZ codes, is actually contrary to the right to freedom of expression. And that type of thing should not be permitted or encouraged. So there is precedent for governments trying to put this type of thing in place, and hasn't really found favor in sensible jurisdictions. The media appeals tribunal, again, or any other form of regulation, must not have the power to impose excessively hefty financial sanctions on the media. Now, in an analogous view, our courts have said that in defamation claims, a very hefty amount that's awarded against the defendant has a chilling effect on freedom of expression. Because effectively, you have to wonder every time you say something, am I going to be found to be wrong later on, and will I end up paying an amount of money that I can't afford because of what I said? And you will, of engage in self-censorship, especially if you're a business and the stakes are quite high. So any power that is given to a tribunal to impose hefty sanctions in terms of fines will have a chilling effect on freedom of expression. And lastly, there's a very limited scope for regulation of content. Content regulations that impose duties on the media to publish certain information or which unduly restrict what can be published would be very difficult to justify. Content regulations that go beyond what is already accepted by the courts in terms of the common law with respect to defamation, privacy, etc., would actually be very difficult to justify because the courts over many years have done a very delicate exercise of balancing the right to freedom of expression and the right to reputation and the right to privacy. And a content restriction that goes beyond the balancing exercise that has been done by the courts will in all probability be constitutionally excessive. So those are some of the considerations that the Press Freedom Commission will have to be thinking about when it's deciding on what form the current regulation should take. So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure there must be some questions. I'll just take them in order. Yes, please.
This question of benefiting a foreign state, that sort of takes us back to the Cold War days in our then laying about the shop it's away. And in a non-military context, like with a country like China, that we're setting up an asbestos mine somewhere, that would be beneficial to the economic side. It seems like it's very capable of just about meaning anything.
Indeed, it could mean anything. And I think that's one of the...
Sorry, why don't you just repeat briefly the question so people at the back can't
hear. The question is, the bill has an offence, the espionage offence, which consists of basically utilising classified information in a way that benefits a foreign state. And the question is, what does benefit a foreign state mean? Is it restricted to economic benefit? Is it restricted to strategic defence benefit? What is it? And the answer is, I really don't know. Those are some of the questions that the courts are going to have to answer if somebody gets accused of having committed espionage because they gave out information which resulted in economic benefit to another country, for example. Those are some of the difficult questions that really only our courts are going to be able to answer because it's very difficult to say in advance what benefit would really mean. I remember I attended a discussion at the Institute for Security Studies in 2010, and there was a guy there who was a former securocrat. And what he said to me was actually quite interesting. He said that the new frontier in information gathering is really technology and economic information. So countries these days are not really engaging so much in espionage that has to do with knowing where all your nuclear weapons are stored. Countries like China, and I'm not just throwing it out there, they are known to be, unfortunately, one of the culprits in this area. They employ people to go up there and to sit all day hacking into other people's information systems so that they can improve themselves technologically. And they're not the only people that are doing it. Most countries are doing it, but I think they're probably doing it quite well. That's why they're advancing and everybody's so scared of them and names them as the number one problem. So basically, just to answer your question, it's very difficult to define the benefit, but it's quite clear that as society is changing, the frontiers of that type of benefit and what will harm South Africa are changing.
Please.
Under the public interest point, talking about, you were raising the concern that the government would have about the cat getting out of the bag in any complaints in that area. As I understand it, that's the mirror image of the problem of espionage. The reason why so few espionage cases come to court is because governments don't want to let the cat out of the bag about a secret that's been let go. Mm. So, presumably, the new legislation has some mechanism for prosecuting espionage without letting the cat out of the bag, and why won't that mechanism also apply for public interest?
Well, it actually doesn't have a mechanism for that. It doesn't have any specific mechanism with respect to prosecuting a person to charge of espionage. What it does have, though, is a general section on how classified information must be dealt with in the courts. And what it says is that when classified information is before a court, no person who is not authorized to get that information can have access to it. So in an espionage case, for example, if someone has been charged and they're in court, no person will actually be able to access the information which is supposedly classified, which this person has not given out to a foreign state. And not only that, but the court has a general power in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, which is a current and existing piece of legislation, to close off court proceedings if they believe that various interests, including the interest of justice, will not be served by people attending. So there's a strong possibility that in a case like that, a court will close the court, that will close the courtroom, and in any event, in terms of the bill, you wouldn't be allowed to have access to whatever court records reflect that information. But we have a judge sitting here.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I just wanted to make one point, apropos. You're absolutely right. You know, there was that famous case, I'm trying to think what his name was. He was the, his wife was Russian and he was in the Navy.
Gerhard.
Now, you may remember, Gerhard was, yes, he was charged with the Cape High Court. If my recollection serve, it was the judge president, Gerald Friedman, I mean, one of my most distinguished judges that ever sat in South Africa.
I know it was Friedman.
And what happened in that case was the judge, I know it was, because I've discussed aspects with him, it was definitely him. And the question about, but the point about the case was it was all in secret. And in fact, none of that record is available. If you go down to the Cape High Court, you won't find it. Right? So that was a classic example of an espionage case where the court made its own rules, i.e. it sat in camera, it didn't allow the public in, and it certainly had certain restrictive conditions as to how the lawyers in the case could deal with the information. And that applies generally. I mean, we do that every day with cases, children. And you know, I mean, you know, I get on an ordinary urgent application all sorts of cases dealing with children. Never get reported. Can't be. And in fact, just to finally say, I once had one, which, an extraordinary case, not that long ago, with a child who wanted, in effect, a form of tacit emancipation from her parents. That's a story all of its own, which I won't detain you with, but I mean, you can go on for hours about it, it's very fascinating. But the point about it was that at some particular point, having granted her an order that she could live with parents of a friend and was managing the process, it came to my attention that there was some allegation, that the newspapers got hold of it, and there was an allegation, proved unproved, that the parents were prepared to sell the story for some cash. Right? Now, whether that was true or not, I don't know. I can tell you right now, made an order saying absolutely nobody is going to report this case, and you'll be in very serious trouble if you do. So courts are able to manage that all the time. So in answer to your question on the espionage, there's no reason to have it in this legislation, because it's governed generally by the ordinary inherent jurisdiction that courts have.
And the point that Dennis makes is actually leads me to one of the other issues that I had in the canvas about the way that the legislation effectively seeks to dictate to courts how they must deal with classified information. It requires that if a classified document is before the court, first of all, that no person can access it without a court order that says that they can. It says that the court must call for submissions from a relevant person from the security services. I think it's the director general in the Ministry of State Security must be called upon to give submission to the court on why this document must be kept secret. And in fact, in a previous draft, thankfully, it's not even there. It had even said that any minister can apply to court for a document which is not even classified to be withheld under the same. So it actually was quite draconian in the way that it was used to dictate to a court how it must deal with classified information. And as you quite rightly point out, it's all unnecessary because the court has an inherent jurisdiction to decide how to deal with documents. But this legislation basically wants to ensure that a court cannot deal with it in certain ways.
I just want to, if I can, just abuse, I'll take your question up, but abuse my privilege here to ask you a question, because it's one much more appropriately asked of a practicing lawyer than a judge. If you look at this, thank goodness we don't give advice. The point about it is that, I'm serious, Protection of State Information Bill, one of the problems that you've got with regard to this is you're going to get caught. If this goes through, by your clients, your firm, lots of clients who run newspapers, and the editor's going to say to you, can I publish this? And you're going to have to make a call saying, there's no possible, in other words, you're going to have to make a call looking at, say, the way it's been classified to say, there's no, because in fairness to them, they have this clause. It says you can't classify information if it's about hiding corruption and so on and so forth. I've got it somewhere here, you know good enough. So the question is, you get tomorrow morning to come back to, the bill's gone through, and come back a question that was posed to me earlier this week. You get a newspaper editor who says, I've got information in relation to the arms deal, right? And it's been classified. But I think it's been classified only for one reason, because we can report who got the money. What are you going to, I mean, isn't this going to put enormous burdens on you people? How are you going to deal with it?
Well, we get paid to deal with these issues.
I know that. You see, that's the trouble about this law. A serious problem.
I wouldn't want to go into too much detail because such things probably will happen. But I mean, there's two ways of dealing with something like that. If there is no public interest defense in the law, and I mean, we've got counsel sitting here as well, so we can put our first of all.
Yeah, you can brief counsel now, yeah.
You can say to the client, publish and be damned. You know, let's make a big hoo-ha out of this. This is a classic public interest type case, and it's going to go all the way up to the Constitutional Court, and no court in its right mind will not allow you to publish this. And after this, the court will strike down the legislation for not having a public interest defense, and it will be declared unconstitutional. That's one way of dealing with it. And in fact, it's one of the ways that's been mooted of how to deal with this legislation. Should, if it goes through without a public interest defense, should the media and everybody else rush through to the Constitutional Court immediately and make an issue out of it? Or should you sit patiently and wait until the right case comes along and somebody gets taken away in handcuffs, so that it's actually a pressing matter which the court can see this is actually crime of justice before, and it's not an academic debate about what shouldn't be involved. So it's an issue that's very real. Or secondly, you could say to them, as we've done in the recent Mac Maharaj matter, because we're acting for the name of Guardian in the Mac Maharaj.
It's a good example.
I'm sure if you guys have followed it. Basically, the allegation is that Mac Maharaj appeared before a commission of inquiry under the National Prosecuting Authority Act and was asked certain questions and gave certain answers, which I'm prohibited from disclosing here, and that those answers indicate, that's what I can say because it's published in the newspapers, that he lied during the NPA inquiry. So our client wants to publish those answers, so that everybody can see for themselves he did that, because they say they have information which disproves the things that he said during the inquiry. But in terms of the NPA Act, it is an offence to publish material obtained during such an inquiry, because it's a special type of procedure where instead of being accused and arrested and put through a normal court process, the NPA calls you and says, look, we've got various questions that we need to ask you. Usually that means they're after somebody else or some other information, not you. Because once they ask you these questions, you're compelled to answer truthfully, and it's an offense not to answer truthfully, but they can't use the information against you. So it's that type of procedure where you're encouraged to give out information. And that's why usually they would use it as a fishing expedition to go after somebody else that you've been associated with. But the point is that nobody can publish this information. And that's the type of inquiry that Maharaj and his wife were called to. So we were then sitting with a situation where we told, we're going to run the story. We got a letter from Maharaj's lawyer saying, if you run the story, we'll be publishing a contravention of the NPA Act and charging you all sorts of things, which they've subsequently done anyway. And we had to advise the client and say, look, we don't think that this is a good idea. But the reason why, and of course, I mean, there was government was saying, publish and be damned, but I think good sense won the day there. And we said, look, you can't publish this. And the reason for that is because the NPA Act has a provision in terms of which you can actually request access to those documents from the National Director of Public Prosecutions, and he has a discretion to permit the disclosure of those documents. So before you've gone through that process, you'd be jumping the gun to publish. You have to go through that process, even if you know what the conclusion is going to be, and incidentally, the conclusion has been what we anticipated, they have refused. And so we're now in a position of deciding, what are we going to do now? Because we've gone through that process and they refuse to hand over, to permit the publication of that information. So this is the kind of thing that would happen with this legislation. And because the legislation permits any person to apply for access to information of a classified document, and the minister would have to then decide, the head of the organ state would have to decide, and presumably you can then go to court, etc., etc., it would be very difficult to then say to a client, publish and be damned. Because I think most sensible courts would then say, why are you running around publishing things without asking for permission when you're allowed to ask for permission? You don't know what's going to happen when you ask for permission, even though, quite frankly, you do. But a court would never say that. They would say, you must go and ask for permission. So if the legislation goes through without a defense, it will probably involve a lot of red tape and a lot of asking for things that you know you're not going to get before you get to a position where you can actually challenge it constitutionally.
Right, one final question at the back. We need to end. I'll simply say, you know, if you look at what the design of the constitutional section on expression was, it did limit expression, it's true, in two ways: internal limiter in relation to hate speech, external limiter, the general limitation clause. But by and large, it intended us to have as wide an expression within those framework as possible. The philosophy being better, more speech than less. I think that's a pretty wise rule of thumb.
And just to pick up exactly there, the other important piece of legislation that was passed dealing with information is the Promotion of Access to Information Act, PIA, which was passed, you know, a lot closer to our transition into democracy. And that set up a mechanism where, on application, you could obtain access to information held by government departments. And it's been used very successfully in strategic litigation around public interest issues and socioeconomic rights and the like. And, you know, a lot of commentators have talked about how that piece of legislation, when you contrast it with the secrecy bill, you can see how a government that's now been in power for, you know, more than a decade, how its concerns around the use of information, the way the burgeoning media platforms, you know, that are across so many different avenues and devices at the moment, that type of information proliferation is actually causing a lot of concern with respect to government priorities. I think there's a second point which just ties it back to the first lecture that we looked at and the second, where you can see the incredible amount of pressure that's going to be put on courts and on the judiciary, because they're going to be the ones who have to give content to these concepts. What is national security? What is national interest? What is benefit of foreign state? What is reasonable? What is you ought reasonably to have known? What does that mean? There's an offense for harboring or concealing a person that you knew or ought reasonably to have known would have this kind of information. So, you know, I have a very good friend who's one of the top investigative journalists for the Sunday Times, and his wife keeps looking at him and saying, you know, am I supposed to know what you've got in your briefcase, and am I going to be in trouble and guilty of an offense in due course? And so you can see that, in a sense, because we're not having a sensible, rigorous public discourse, public dialogue, using sort of traditional political avenues to flesh out what this all means and try to come to some sort of national consensus on these questions, we're instead just leaving it to the courts. The courts will decide in due course. And that's going to put a lot more pressure on that institution. So I'm left with two tasks for this evening. The one is to invite you to all return for the final lecture tomorrow evening, where Dennis and I will reflect on the week and try to pull together themes that have developed over the week, as well as looking ahead at the legal year as we can forecast it for now, some of the cases that we can see are coming up. And then lastly, just to thank Oshrega for not only departing the joys of Sandton and coming down to Cape Town, but also for giving such a fantastic, comprehensive and insightful presentation this evening. So thank you very much.
So much.
Customers
are very happy.